The choir of New College Oxford singing Happy is the Man That Findeth Wisdom. This anthem was originally composed for Charles Darwin's funeral in 1882, but it was sung again at the memorial service of another biologist, more recently, on the 1st of July in the year 2000. And there's more to link this week's great life with Darwin than that piece of music. He's been described as the most distinguished Darwinian since Darwin, the most influential evolutionary biologist of his generation, and even the only bloody genius we've got. He is William Donald Hamilton, otherwise known as Bill Hamilton, born in 1936 and died in 2000 at the age of 63. And with me this week, choosing his great life, is Richard Dawkins, Emeritus Professor of Public Understanding of Science at Oxford, where he's been for 40 years.
I'm delighted that you managed to get that music, because I'd no idea it was recorded. That anthem, as you said, was sung at his funeral, and it was my belief that it had never been sung since the funeral of Charles Darwin, for whom it was specially written.
Professor Dawkins, I'm so eager to find out more about Bill Hamilton that you'll forgive me for summarising your potted biography brutally, because few, if any, of our listeners will not know who you are. Born in Africa, like me, in Nyasaland as a boy, before my boyhood took me there, he started at Oxford and, after a spell at the University of California, Berkeley, returned to Oxford and has never left. He became one of the world's most eminent Darwinians, and, incidentally, most famous atheists. His works of popular science, The Selfish Gene, The God Delusion, there are many, perhaps obscuring in the public mind his enormous academic contribution to the taking of Darwinism forward into the world of DNA and genes, and, fascinatingly, the propagation and reproduction of ideas and beliefs. But look, most of this would be common currency at any intelligent dinner party. But nobody, except, you may say, those who matter, has heard of Bill Hamilton. Yet look at the obituaries. More original and more profound than any other biologist since Darwin. Who was he, Richard? Why have you chosen him? And why is he so little known?
Charles Darwin left a number of problems unsolved. And others, of course, have come along and solved them later. But I think that Bill Hamilton perhaps did more than anybody else to tidy up what was left over from Darwin. And he was a rather similar type to Darwin in a way, both of them great naturalists, both of them brilliant, deep thinkers. The work for which he's most famous is the work on altruism, which is one of the problems left over from Darwin. Why do animals work for the good of other animals? Before he came along, the dominant theory was individual fitness. Individuals work to survive and reproduce, and the measure of an individual's success, in Darwinian terms, was how many offspring, grand offspring, descendants it had. Bill Hamilton generalized that to inclusive fitness, which included the contributions that the individual makes to the survival not only of its own offspring, but the survival of the offspring of relatives. And the reason for that, which he was absolutely clear about, is that relatives share genes. And if natural selection works as it does at the level of the gene, genes become more frequent in the population as generations go by if they're successful. A major part of that success is not only making the individual possessing the gene good at surviving, but making it good at looking after the survival of other individuals with a good probability of sharing the same genes. Brothers, sisters, nephews, nieces, great-nieces, cousins, etc.
Do you know, I can see in this a river which, divided, follows both the courses that your own career has followed. Firstly, the work on DNA, on genes, the selfish gene, the scientific side. Secondly, the explanation of what those people of a religious disposition would call virtue and vice, purely in evolutionary terms, without reference to any divine authority.
Well, yes, and if you're looking for an evolutionary origin for ideas like virtue and vice, for ideas of good and evil, selfishness and altruism. Bill Hamilton contributed that. Now, that doesn't mean that we or he or biologists generally think that's the sole explanation for why humans are nice to each other. But it probably is a fairly major component to it. There probably is a Darwinian substrate, a Darwinian basis for our feeling of empathy, sympathy, and desire to help and cooperate with others.
Your estimation of Bill Hamilton is absolutely plain. Was he inspirational for you, as well as admirable because he was right?
He certainly was inspirational for me. I mean, my first book, The Selfish Gene, is very largely inspired by him. Not just the theory of altruism, but other things as well.
And as a man?
As a man, a wonderful colleague, a modest friend. He didn't blow his own trumpet in the way that most very successful scientists do. And so that possibly is why he was less well known. But he made enormous contributions in several different fields. And he was so self-effacing that he tended to put his contributions in little incidental asides as well as in major papers. He would suddenly find a little nugget of gold buried in a paragraph somewhere in the middle of a paper about something else, which summed up something that other people had been arguing about for years and sort of got the right answer.
He even, I believe, slipped them into book reviews of other people's work.
That's right. That's a typical thing he would do. Writing a book review about somebody else, he would just sort of muse and say, well, I was thinking about this, and then he would produce a brilliant idea, which was just kind of lost in the middle of this book review until somebody else later dug it out.
To tell us more about the man and his impact, we have with us Consultant Emeritus in Geriatric Medicine and the sister of Bill Hamilton, Dr. Mary Bliss. Dr. Bliss, are you an older sister or a younger sister?
Yes, I'm 1 year older than Bill.
What was Bill like as a boy?
I think I recognised from very early on that he was an outstanding brother and an outstanding person. It was very obvious, in fact, that he sort of thought about things far more than most of us think about things. And even though I had a reasonably high opinion of myself, because I had some talents which Bill didn't have, I still would have deferred to Bill's opinion almost always during my association with him in childhood. And we were very close. We did almost everything together in our early childhood, played together, and we had an imaginary friend which we shared and talked about. We played dolls together. We played in the garden together. We would just sit there for sometimes what seemed like hours, just sort of drifting along. We had a lift, and it was a lift that went up in the sky, and this person and we went up in the sky together and sort of drifted around and had adventures in the clouds. But his main activity when he was young was collecting butterflies, and that was his sort of absorbing passion, really.
It's not a word to be used lightly, but I think it's right to say that he was a genius. And I ask you first, Mary, whether during his childhood any sense that he was a genius began to grow among you, and then ask you, Richard, how early in his academic career people learnt that. Mary?
Well, I think without any question at all, I've always regarded him as a genius. You know, I didn't really ever question it, and I didn't think about it particularly as being unusual, but it was just a fact as far as I was concerned. And I don't know whether, well, I do know, actually, whether he himself regarded himself as a genius, because his archivist in the British Library, Jeremy John, has told me that he had a diary which I was not allowed to be privy to, which I didn't know about when I was young, in which he actually says, I'm a genius and I have work to do.
Does that surprise you, Richard?
That does surprise me a little bit. When he was a graduate student doing his most famous work, although I should say that he did a lot of almost equally famous work much later. But when he was a graduate student, he was not recognised and actually felt a bit hard about that and was intensely lonely at that time. He became recognised in a very big way about 10 years later, in about 1974. I actually plotted it out because I took his famous 1964 paper and counted the number of citations of it year to year And there's almost nothing from 64 up until 1974. In 1974, it suddenly starts to rocket upwards. They're difficult to read. I mean, the mathematics he uses is difficult, rather idiosyncratic. It took a while for people to catch on to the importance of it.
Was he a good communicator?
He could be. He could be terrible. And he had a reputation for being a bad communicator, but I have heard him give extremely good lectures. He was an elegant communicator, filled with literary allusions on paper.
Is it possible, do you think, to be a good communicator to the public at large, to be accessible, to be known and to be admired by the public, and to maintain your reputation with your colleagues professionally?
It certainly should be, because many of the best communicators have been very, very good, very, very good scientists. Mm. It is true that some scientists who have given their lives over to communicating with the public have suffered in reputation.
You get a bit of sniping, don't you?
If I do, it's behind my back, so
believe
yes,
me.
Yes.
Mary, did you stay in touch with your brother as he immersed himself in his chosen field and gradually became famous? How close did you stay to him?
Well, to begin with, we were still very, very closely in touch indeed. We had mutual friends and corresponded all the time, really. I have a huge collection of postcards from Bill which do outline some of his early theories on altruism and so on quite clearly. But gradually, as we got older, as I graduated and then went to work in hospitals, and he went to Cambridge where he, and met some friends of his own, although he wasn't particularly happy in Cambridge.
Was he not? Why not?
Well, I think Richard would be able to describe this better than I, but he found that the biological teachers there were not interested in the ideas that Bill was interested
in. That's true, yes.
And really discouraged him, if anything. He was saved by finding the work of Fisher.
R.A. Fisher's the other obvious candidate for the title of greatest Darwinian since Darwin, and he flourished in the 1930s. But apart from Fisher, there was very little interest in evolution at Cambridge at the time. That's now changed. Biology at Cambridge at the time was almost contemptuous of the study of evolution, as though it was kind of just sort of natural history. And so Bill was lonely there. And then again, when he went to London, he had trouble finding anybody to supervise his research because nobody really quite understood what he was on about.
I can understand this difficulty, as you say, when someone is thinking in completely different ways. I read, reading up about Bill Hamilton, that he had concluded that the tree's leaves turn red in autumn as a way of warning insects not to try to propagate themselves by laying their eggs in the leaves. And I thought, that's ridiculous.
Yes.
No tree is trying to warn anybody of anything. Now, explain,
well,
what did he mean?
That was much later. I mean, that was toward the end of his life. And it was one of a clutch of theories that he sort of tossed off late in life. Absolutely fascinating. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it from a Darwinian theory point of view. It's perfectly plausible, isn't there? There's no reason why natural selection shouldn't favour trees that issue warnings. I mean, of course, you have to understand it's not a deliberate thing. Mm. It's all done in a sort of as-if way. I mean, another of his late theories, which is equally fascinating, I was reminded of when Mary was talking about this lift up into the clouds, because another of Bill's late theories was that clouds themselves are filled with microorganisms which are using the clouds as devices to propagate themselves. And that is an absolutely typical Bill Hamilton idea. And once again, there's nothing wrong with it in theory. It's completely
really
out of the box. It's a really weird idea.
Yeah.
But it's not an unrespectable theory from a Darwinian point of view. You'd need a lot of evidence to confirm it.
This is BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris, and you're listening to Great Lives, where Richard Dawkins, my guest this week, has chosen the life of the scientist Bill Hamilton, whose sister, Dr. Mary Bliss, is with us as our expert witness. Mary, did your brother marry?
Yes, he did. He married a friend of my youngest sister's, and he had three children. His wife, Christine, was a dentist, although she is also now retired. She shared a lot of his sort of adventures. She went to Brazil with him on pioneering efforts to collect wasps to support his theories and so on.
What was he like as a colleague, Richard? In 1984, he was appointed to a Royal Society research professorship at Oxford and became your colleague. Was it easy to work with?
Yes, he was a lovely colleague. He was always ready to discuss. He was famously absent-minded. I mean, he would sit in his office working hard and thinking and reading and doing computer programming and things like that. And I formed the habit, whenever there was an interesting seminar that I thought he would like to go to, I would knock on his door exactly 5 minutes before the seminar. Not earlier, or he would forget. I would say, there's a very good seminar about so-and-so just about to happen, and he would look up and beam, and we would go together. He once was accosted by a colleague in the zoology department who said, "Bill, I'm so sorry, I missed your lecture yesterday." And Bill said, "That's all right, I'm afraid I missed it too."
And he was a famous cyclist, by all accounts.
Well, he rode very fast on his bicycle, which had originally belonged to one of his brothers. Was it the only one?
Yes, the youngest brother, who died in an accident, a cliff-climbing accident at the age of 19, much to everybody's sorrow. And I think Bill rode that bicycle in memory of him.
And he rode it very fast. Because he had a great shock of grey hair, people thought he couldn't, you know, somebody of his age couldn't possibly ride a bike that fast, which caused motorists to make wrong judgments.
I read somewhere that a £15,000 cheque had blown out of his basket.
Well, that's another of the famous stories about him, that a cheque from the Royal Society blew out of his basket while he was cycling along, yes. I actually heard that one at first hand, so that one probably is true, although some of the stories about him are not true.
I know it's deceptively difficult to summarise what really distinguishes an individual's great contribution to science in his or her field. But, and this is a very big ask, I realise, would you try Richard Dawkins? What was it that made his work brilliant? Is there a core? Is there a kernel to it?
Well, first I ought to say that although we've talked about the theory of altruism, which he came up with in the 1960s, that was only the first of many great contributions that he made. And he himself, if he were here, would probably prefer us to talk about his work on the evolution of sex and sexual selection, because the great riddle in evolutionary theory, even today, is the question of why sex exists at all. Because on the simple idea that individuals are maximising the number of their genes that get passed on, we ought to have no males, and females should reproduce without sex, producing clones of themselves. And so there's been a big theoretical effort to try to solve that problem. And Bill was one of the major players in that. And his theory involved evolutionary arms races between hosts and parasites. So he had the idea that when females choose males, it's almost as though females are like diagnostic doctors, looking the males over and choosing the healthiest males to breed with. And the males, for their part, are making it easy for the females to act as doctors. It's as though the males evolve, actually grow thermometers sticking out of their mouths to enable the females to diagnose how healthy they are. And these thermometers were, in Bill's view, these brightly coloured feathers and plumes and advertisements, whereas before, for Fisher, it was just whatever the females happened to like for whatever reason. They just like brightly coloured feathers. For Bill, brightly coloured feathers were a kind of badge of health.
Like dancing and fighting.
Dancing and fighting would be good examples, because these are unfakeable badges of how healthy you are.
What the mate is looking for in another mate is then partly someone with an additional range of armoury. Is it against the parasites so that they can share their armour?
Well, it would
or the
rather,
children can.
Yes, that would be part of it, but probably not all of it. It's that because there is this arms race between hosts and parasites, and because parasites are evolving so fast, I mean, viruses and bacteria have tiny generation time, so they're evolving immensely fast. The recipe for what makes a good individual for surviving is constantly changing. It's not static. I mean, we can imagine certain bits of it are, like maybe being able to run fast would be one part of the recipe. But so important was the impact of parasites on survival, in Bill's view, that bright colours would be a badge of ability to be resistant to have come through and survived the ravages yes. of whatever parasites happen to be around at the moment.
He held a bleak view, didn't he, about the prospects for mankind of the intertwining of science with our species. What wasn't one of his fears that we would kind of lose our evolutionary edge by trying to live longer and trying to treat illnesses instead of letting people die?
I think...
I think you're quite completely right. I think it was a major preoccupation and worry of his. He really felt that medical science, particularly in trying to prevent the death, trying desperately to prevent death in every aspect, it didn't matter so much preventing perhaps death in very old people, but he felt that very strongly that it did matter in preventing the deaths of, say, malformed embryos and neonates, newly born babies and so on, because it prevented evolution from working in the way that it has always worked, in that evolution depends on allowing insisting, really, that the individuals, the genes that are not good for survival, don't survive.
The trouble with this argument, or it's not the trouble with it as an argument, but the danger with this argument is it's quite a saloon bar sort of argument, or it can be turned into a saloon bar argument and make someone look like a crude believer in eugenics, which of course he wasn't.
But it's an intensely unfashionable view, and he was aware of that. And it's one of the respects in which his reputation has suffered, because people have labelled him as a eugenicist in the sense that you suggest.
Tell me, Mary, about his theory that he was immune to malaria.
Yes, that was rather foolish of him, really, wasn't it? But as he was an expert on parasites, I think the reason for it was simply that he'd spent very many years in Brazil on many occasions and had not taken prophylactic drugs. And in fact, actually, even when he was in Brazil, he felt that his immunity to malaria dated from much, much earlier, when he was aged about 20 and made an expedition to Belgrade by bicycle with another brother.
What happened?
And got malaria in Belgrade when he was there. And he felt that this had endowed him with immunity for the rest of his life, so he didn't take anti-malarial drugs in Brazil and got by. He never got malaria, as far as we know. But when he eventually went to the Congo on another expedition, he did develop malaria and died from the complications of that.
What was the expedition to the Congo in pursuit of, Richard?
Well, it was in pursuit of a particular theory, which now seems to be actually wrong, but which Bill felt was serious enough to be worth considering, about the origin of AIDS.
It was from the polio vaccine
Yes, it was, yes. I think it's probably not worth talking about because, as I think Bill would probably himself now agree, the evidence since then has not supported the theory.
While the rest of us speak and think in notes, someone said about him, Bill thought in chords. Richard, those of us with what might be called the gift of the gab, with a talent perhaps for gaining attention and an insistent desire to communicate, might in our quieter moments feel not so much guilty, but a sense of injustice that quiet genius has been left unremarked. I do about my brother. I have a brother a year younger than me who is so much cleverer than me. Is there anything of that in your homage to Bill Hamilton? You have said that you used quite a lot of his work in The Selfish Gene, and you are very famous. He never became famous. Do you feel there's something a little unjust there?
I don't think it's right to say that Bill ended up unrecognised. I mean, he was unrecognised at a time when it would have been very important to him to have been recognised as a young man. But in his later life, I mean, after the mid-1970s and increasingly so, he was actually hugely recognised in the scientific community, not in the public sphere, I suppose. He was greatly honoured in his own lifetime, but not early enough, I think I would say.
Do you think he would have liked to have been an almost public figure in the way that you are?
I don't know about that. I doubt it.
You don't, Mary?
No, I don't think it would have interested him particularly.
I don't think
he was much more interested in having the approval of like-minded colleagues. That did weigh very heavily with him. He was very pleased if people you know, appreciated his ideas and so on, and didn't like it when they didn't either.
Yes.
But the public, I don't think he ever really aspired to engage the public.
And if Mary Higgy could see us now and see that Professor Richard Dawkins is championing him as a great life, what do you think his reaction would be?
Well, of course, he's always known that Richard championed him as a great life because Richard wrote The Selfish Gene, which was the explanation of his theories, which he wasn't very good at explaining himself, and Richard has a wonderful facility for doing that. And in fact, I think Richard not only explained them to the public, but also even explained them to other scientists as well, and so that they were then able to take up these ideas and turn them into the now very important sciences of studying the selfish gene and sociobiology.
Interesting, though, that you go immediately in response to my question back to science and to his estimation in the world of science. Wouldn't he have been pleased that he was on national radio?
Well, there's a whole aspect of Bill which we haven't touched on at all, and that is his extreme interest in the arts and literature.
You can see the poetry, Richard, in much of what
yes.
he wrote.
I mean, one of his favourite poets was A.E. Housman. Hmm. And I think of Bill as being a bit like the Shropshire Lad in the slightly melancholy, solitary approach to life. Do you think, Mary, or not?
Yes, I think both of them shared a feeling that things weren't going to go on like this forever.
He wrote once in an article that he wished, when he died, to be laid out on the forest floor in the Amazon jungle and interred by burying beetles as food for their larvae. Would you mind just reading out, Richard, the continuation?
Burying beetles, I should explain, they make their living by taking corpses and taking them underground, and then they lay their eggs in them, and then the larvae hatch and eventually emerge the next year as flying adults. Later, in their children, reared with care by the horned parents of fist-sized balls moulded from my flesh, I will escape. No worm for me or sordid fly. Rearranged and multiple, I will at last buzz from the soil like bees out of a nest. Indeed, buzz louder than bees, almost like a swarm of motorbikes. I shall be born beetle by flying beetle out into the Brazilian wilderness beneath the stars. This image of blue iridescent wings flying up into the Brazilian jungle, I think it's a beautiful poetic fancy.
My thanks to my guest this week, Richard Dawkins, who chose Bill Hamilton, and to our expert witness, his sister, Dr. Mary Bliss. Goodbye.